Robbie W. from Vineland, New Jersey. Please welcome Robbie W.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Rob, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Rob.
I got a microphone. Isn't that nice? I want to thank everybody for showing up tonight. You know, my home group is the Stagecoach group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We meet just outside of Ocean City, New Jersey, very southern end of New Jersey, in a little town called Marmora. We have 5 meetings a day, 10 in the morning, 1 in the afternoon, 5:30 at night, 8 o'clock at night, and our 10 o'clock meeting at night is called the Fog Lifters Meeting. A lot of fog gets lifted. Currently, I chair the Monday at 8 p.m. meeting. I have a fellow named Tim from my home group. I called him the way up here. He's handling that for me tonight. But if you're ever in southern New Jersey, ask for my number before I leave tonight, and I'll get you to my home group. And it's an old-fashioned AA group. We meet for an hour and a half. Every one of our meetings are an hour and a half. And we have speaker discussion meetings, we have big book meetings, 12 and 12 meetings, as Bill sees it meetings, tradition meetings, and on and on and on. It's a real good group. We'd love to have you. My sobriety date is November 1st of 1983. One day at a time. I got sober when I was 22 years old. I'm 42 today. The only problem with that is the longer you stay sober, the older you get. So sobriety has been good to me. I love AA, and I love everything about it today. Didn't like it at first, but I'll share about that. Want to welcome you back to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous with your 80, or how many days? 84 days. That's awesome, man. Congratulations. Keep it up. Keep sitting up front. You're in the right seat. Want to thank Mike and Billy for asking me to share tonight. It's always an honor when I get a chance to share in front of alcoholics at an AA meeting. You know, none of this ever goes to my head, you know, when I'm here, because I know, you know, why I'm here. I'm here tonight, you know, to share my experience, my strength, and my hope with the disease of alcoholism, you know, what it did to me, you know, what happened and what it's like today. That's all. It's my turn to be up here. I love sitting out there. In fact, we were talking about before the meeting, I love doing service work more than this, you know, but whatever I'm asked to do, I do. I don't question, you know, what would the master do? You know, where am I supposed to be of maximum service to God and others? And tonight that's here. You know, tonight it's right here, and I'm grateful to be here, and thanks for welcoming me to your group. I love to start out my talk just for a moment to ask everybody, if you will, just for a silent moment of reflection. I'd like to ask everybody just for a second, just to bow your heads, if you will, with me, and to ask our higher power to come into the room tonight so that he can come into my heart and speak through it, and hopefully as well come into your heart so you guys can listen through it. If you will, we'll meet back here just in a few seconds. Thank you, everybody. I know for me, when I do that before I start, when I force myself to do that, just like when I force myself to get on my knees in the morning when I get up to say my prayers, that now I'm speaking the language of the heart, which Bill Wilson, our founder, Bill W., commonly referred to a lot, and not the language of the gutter. You know, not my deal. You know, when I'm up in front of alcoholics at an AA room, I really don't share my opinions. You know, it has nothing, as far as I'm concerned, it has nothing to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. I share my experiences, my strengths, and my hope. You know, I know that while I may not represent Alcoholics Anonymous tonight, I represent AA at work, you see. I represent AA in my family, okay? I represent Alcoholics Anonymous out there on the road. I really do. You know, and that's not my ego talking. My employer and employees at my job, they know I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous. So it doesn't look too good when I'm there, maybe, you know, using that guttural language. Hey, what's the matter with you? I'll knock you on your, you know who I am and all that stuff. Or when I'm out there on the road, when I'm acting like that, I'm certainly not being a good example of Alcoholics Anonymous, especially if I have a bumper sticker that says, you know, there but for the grace of God go I, you know. But anyway, I'm a real grateful member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love what Bill says in the Big Book. And he says that in There's a Solution. He says, we alcoholics, we're like the passengers on a great ship liner. The moment after shipwreck, where joyousness and camaraderie pervade the vessel, you know. And I think what he's talking about is when we come to AA with our stories, you know, what happened to us, you know, how we got beaten and battered by the storms, how we finally land in this wonderful island called Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. But then Bill's funny. You really have to watch Bill, because Bill was a very, very smart man, and could tell that, you know, he really got deep. And the next sentence says, but that in itself would not be enough for people like us to keep us here as we are today as a fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. In fact, he says that's only one of the powerful elements of cement that holds us together, our stories. Imagine if all we did was come here and talk about our stories. Imagine if all we did was come here and say, yeah, I drank here, I went to this jail and that prison, and I lost this wife and that husband, and da-da-da-da, and I'm going to meeting tomorrow. You going? Yeah, I'll be at that step meeting. That sucker Mike's going to share. That guy Billy that thinks he's funny is going to share. And ay, 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 ay. And wouldn't it just be horrible? Wouldn't it just be horrible? That's all we talked about. I believe it would be. And then Bill backs me up. The next paragraph, he says, the tremendous fact is that we found a common solution, one in which we can agree and join in brotherly and harmonious action. You see? And that's so important. You know, like today, like, oh my God, it's so easy for me, especially when I was newer, to pick out what somebody says, man, woman, whatever, that I don't agree with. Oh, I don't believe in that. Oh, I don't believe in this. And oh, you know what? And to take other people's inventories. You know, but for me today, I have to force myself to, you know, to get along, you know, to join in with the solution and to agree with you guys, especially in a business meeting, you know, to join in brotherly and harmonious action. See, because that's when something really, a synergy takes place. You know, I studied in school, and synergy is when you just put two elements and you put them on a table side by side, nothing happens. But when you put them together, something happens. And when you put us together, working together in unity, like it says in our traditions, all of a sudden something wonderful takes place. And I believe, you know, that is when a God comes into AA, and he allows us and helps us to learn how to be citizens again, how to be husbands and wives and employees and whatever it is. You know, sons, daughters, it doesn't matter. Grandmothers, grandfathers, it doesn't matter. But it just helps us be human beings again. Bill says in the book, an alcoholic in his or her cups is an unlovely creature. You know, and that was so me. When I put a drink of alcohol in me, I was just a nut. And let me talk about that a little bit. You know, my first drink, my story begins, you know, with my family in Philadelphia. I was born and raised in Philadelphia. Okay, and my family's perfect, man. My family, you know, just like the Brady Bunch, you know, Jan and Mike Brady, man. My mom and dad, they were just so awesome. They wore the old-fashioned clothes. They were, you know, nice as could be. You know, dad smoked a pipe like Ward Cleaver. You know what I mean? My mom was just, you know, sent me and my little sister to Catholic schooling, and I always had the best Chuck Taylor Converse sneakers. I had an Easter suit. You know what I mean? I had everything I ever wanted. Nurturing. I mean, you know, it was just, you know, if they were going to spank me, they told me why. You know what I mean? Like that type of thing. It was just a great upbringing, man. Like I was not abused. You know, and we all have different stories. I know a lot of us come from broken families and abuse, alcohol and drugs and sexual and all that stuff. I don't come from any of that, man. I come from just a wonderful middle class family in Philadelphia, a Catholic upbringing. I loved Catholic school, first to eighth grade before I picked up a drink. I mean, I used to clap the erasers for the nuns. You know what I mean? Like I was in the best reading classes and science classes. And I just loved school, never missed a day, volunteered for everything. I did projects. I took weeks on projects that other kids did in a couple hours. And I just showed everybody up. Man, I was going to be somebody, you know. And then eighth grade summer, I went to a Yes concert. And for all your old-timers, that's a rock and roll group. And I went to this Yes concert, and I had a pint. My first drink was a pint of Southern Comfort, okay, mixed with nacho cheese Dorito corn chips. And I proceeded during this song called Roundabout, which is their bit. All these lights came on, and I projectile vomited in front of this, on this guy with real long, black, nappy hair. Well, I made it nappier. And it was just horrible. It was a horrible feeling coming out and all those tough chips coming up and out the nose. And it was just horrible. It was horrible. It was a horrible feeling. And I was to pursue that feeling for many, many years, you know. And I can't explain it. But when a drink went in me, something happened. And I changed. That Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. You know, I played football growing up, all from a little kid. And I was always the quarterback. Like third string, all right? I played shortstop on the baseball teams growing up, and I was always, you know, the shortstop, man, like second string. I played basketball. I barely made the team. I'm on the bench saying, let's go, Big Bill, and all that. I was always involved, but I was never the man, you know? But when I went to the corner, with the brew, I was like the head tap man from my corner. You know what I mean? And so when I drank, something happened. I could become, I was a part of a wonderful deal called drinking with these kids in high school. Now, I mean, high school was just a blur. High school was just one party after another party after another party. I went to a private Catholic high school, prep, all boys. You know, so you would think, well, there's going to be some higher learning here. You know, we're not checking out all the girls, and we're not, you know, we're, our minds aren't somewhere where it shouldn't be. We're focused. We have oblates that St. Francis teaching us. You know, I got all these courses like trigonometry and calculus and chemistry, right? Physics and all this stuff. And I didn't get nothing out of high school because all I could think about was drinking. And me and all the boys, we would drink during school. You know, we would drink during school. We would drink at night. The whole week would be planned about, you know, where are we going to be Saturday night? You know, where are we going to be Friday night? What's going on Sunday? What game are we going to? Who's getting the beer? And I can't explain it, but it just, like it says in the first step, alcohol became the rapacious creditor. You know, I have a sponsor that makes me look stuff up. Rapacious means to take with force. And alcohol took with force everything from me. You know, all will to resist its demands were gone in me. I couldn't resist its demands. My mom got smart. She didn't read all this big book that we have out, you know, where it says that, you know, one drink is too many, 1,000 isn't enough. You know, one of those stories in the book. She didn't read the fact that I have an allergy, you know, which is a mental obsession coupled with a physical compulsion. She didn't read the book where it talked about the phenomenon of craving that I get as an alcoholic. She didn't read that. So she got me to watch Scared Straight. Okay, 3 Saturdays in a row. I'm 16 years old, right? This is the late 70s now. I got the wings going back like Bruce Jenner. You know, I used to spend more time in the bathroom than my little sister because, you know, I had to look good back then. And you know, the disco jeans and all, you know, the silk shirt with the gold and all. And I just thought I was the... But I was drinking. And my mom, for 3 Saturdays in a row, I had... It was horrible. It was like a purgatory if you're a Catholic. She made me stay in every Saturday night and watch Scared Straight, which was these Rahway State prisoners who were doing life. And their way of paying back society was to tell young juvenile delinquents like me what would happen if they continued on their way of drinking like I was doing. And so every Saturday night I would sit and watch these big old guys, hairy, tattooed, ugly, big, nasty, horrible fellas just being mean, you know, to these young guys and just saying things and really scared me for 3 Saturdays in a row. And the 4th Saturday, what do you think I did when I went to the corner? I got drunk, you know, because alcohol represented itself. You see, you couldn't scare me. You see, it worked for a while, but I'm an alcoholic. It was going to take more than a few prisoners that I'm probably never going to meet, you know, inside some penitentiary to scare this deal out of me. See, I got a disease, man. If that's all it took, man, you know, we won't even need this program, you know. So that didn't work. But my mom tried. She meant well. I went through high school. I graduated. Graduated from high school, no problem. It just wasn't. And I got a job. Let me tell you, let me back up just half a second. I graduated from school, and I went down to what we call Senior Week down in Wildwood, New Jersey, from Philly to Wildwood, New Jersey. And that's where all the guys go down and all the girls go down. And by golly, you party for a week. You know, you graduated. And I know this is where, like, the non-alcoholics probably drink a little too much, and it's a little, they're fun and all. And this is where somebody like me just really gets out of hand, you know. And I did. And I went out with this young gal all through high school. Her name was Barbie. And me and Barbie, I mean, we went to all the dances, the freshman dance, the soft hop, the junior prom, the senior prom. And she was from the Catholic prep girls high school and graduated the same year as I did, and I was from the boys. And so the first night there, I showed up at her little hotel room, and I walked in, and she said, "Sit down." And so I could follow direction, right? I'm married. And so I sat down. I sat down, and I saw 4 of her little girlfriend's heads, like, popped out of a bedroom, all looking out. So I knew something was getting ready to go down. And she said, "Robbie, I'm telling you, this happened. As the day is long here. This happened." She said, "Robbie, you drink too much for me, and I'm going to have to let you go. You know, I'm going to go in a different direction." You know how you girls say that to us guys. So she broke up with me, and I was downtrodden. All the way back to the hotel room. I was downtrodden. And I got back to the hotel room, and I told my buddies, "What's wrong, dude?" And I go, "Barbie, just broke up with me, man, and like, you know, a girl I'm going to marry, blonde hair, blue eyes, it's my girl, what am I going to do, and all. And they're all like, yeah, this is great news. And like John Belushi and Animal House, in like 5 seconds, I'm like, yeah, good point. Now we can party, and I'm not going to worry about her and taking her to the bar and being sober enough to take her to the beach and all that crap. And I just drank all night, like a real, all week, like a real alcoholic. And I just, it was just horrible. I mean, just drinking after drinking after drinking. Got home, and there was a letter in the mail from a, and remember, I'm drinking all through high school. So I wasn't going, doing all this preparatory college class that's like some of the boys that I went to school with and become a lawyer and become an attorney and become this and that and next thing. All I wanted to do was drink. So I didn't. I wasn't going to college. I was like prison. You kidding me? But there was a job waiting for me. And my guidance counselor, who looked over me, watched over me, got me a job at a Center City Bank, okay, a federal depository. And I showed up. Now I'm a real alcoholic at this point. I'm only 18 years old, but trust me, I have all the traits at this point in my life. If you were drinking, I'm drinking. I mean, I was hiding it. I couldn't get enough. I was the first one there. I was the last to leave. I would go with you, man, woman, boy, girl, ? I'll still go with you if you're drinking. It didn't even matter if I wasn't even sure what you were. You drinking? Good, let's go. You know? And anyway, I'm an alcoholic. I'm 18 years old. I get a job at a bank. And I'm thinking now it's going to change. I got my hair cut short. You know, I got the tie back on and all my buddies are going off to the war or getting jobs or going to college. And so now I'm getting a job at a bank. And then it happens. And the vice president sits down with me the first, second day. And he tells me, Robbie, if you go through 3 months of probation here at the bank, we're going to send you to Temple University, which was right down at Broad in Columbia. Okay. And if you get A, B's or C's, we're going to pay for it. So it wasn't that great. So I just knew that, you know, I'm going to be the vice president of this place real soon. He better watch out, because my parents didn't have a lot of money, but now they're going to send me to college. And all I had to do was just be a good boy for 90 days. Well, do you think I could have done that? And I was doing good until the next day. And the head bank teller said to me, her name was Joan, still remember that, sick. She says, Robbie, we all go to Froggies after work. And she pointed out the window. And there was a big neon sign that said, Froggies, leap on in, you know? Oh, the hell I remember. I'm an alcoholic. I remember that stuff, you know? All, there was probably a PNC building. There was probably a Walmart. I don't know what else was there, but I remember Froggies. And I leapt on in with the girls that Friday night. And I just thought, you know, I'm an 18-year-old young kid, a boy. I got 4 girls I'm going over to the bar with. You know, I'm just like in heaven. You know, they all like my blue eyes. I'm like, yeah. You know, I'm just thinking, this is just wonderful. Thank you, God. You know, the problem is there's a lot of booze in bars. Okay. You know, if it was just a sandwich joint, if it was a steak joint, I would have been okay, maybe. I don't have an eating problem, you know. But I started drinking and just fell in love with the place. And, like, I'm not really politically correct. I know sometimes I tell this story in my home group and they get mad at me. They think I'm glamorizing it, but I'm not. I'm just telling my story. This is what happened. Alcohol started to romance me. I'll give you for instance. When I was a kid, I used to always ask my mom, because I was always fixated on this. I wanted to know also if Barb was going to be my wife. I wasn't sure. And I'd say, Mom, how am I going to know when I meet the right woman? How am I going to know? That was just one of my things as a kid. And she'd give that typical mom answer. And she'd say, you'll just know. You know? One of those, like, how did you know when Daddy was going? Oh, I just knew, you know? And then she'd say, but and then I probed her all the time. She'd say, you know, well, you'll feel something special. You know, you'll hear music. You may see stars. You may actually hear angels singing, whatever. You know what I mean? Like, I kept on, you know, I guess he just wanted to shut me up and whatever, give me an answer. So I was at Froggy's the end of the second week, and this dude, his name was Mac, he lined up 5 shots, okay, of something. Then he lined up 5 jiggers of something else for me. And then he lined up 5 drafts of Heineken for me. And he walked away. And something happened. I heard those bells go off. I swear to you, as I live and breathe and I stand here, I heard angels singing, Alleluia, you know? And so, like, and that was the truth. And I met my soulmate, and it was called John Barleycorn. or booze. You see, I wasn't really a good social drinker with the girls. They, I think, found out quickly that I drank a little different than they did. And I was there every night. The problem with that when you're a bank teller, I'll share something with you. Bank tellers don't make a lot of money, okay? My parents didn't have a lot of money, you know. And I decided to give myself gradual raises at this bank, okay? Oh, yeah. Yeah, I wasn't as high bottom as you thought. Billy met me out at my vehicle. I come out in my suit in this real nice minivan, and doors open automatically. He says, "Oh, well, high bottom drunk." I said, "Well, wait to hear my story." And I was doing well with this concept for probably a couple weeks. I was very popular at the bar. I was able to take. See, I'm so sick. I thought the cameras were on the people out there trying to rob us. You know what I mean? I think they're looking for Bonnie and Clyde. They ain't looking for me. You know, I'm from Catholic high school. I'm a good kid, short hair. And I showed up for work one day, true story, 18 years old, never been in trouble with the law, never been in the back of a police car. Wouldn't, I mean, never, ever. Why? Why would I? Here's two federal officers. They're called FBI. At the bank, guns, handcuffs, and short hair like mine, and they asked me, "Is your name Robert Walker?" Now I'm an 18-year-old drunk, 18 years old, and again I looked. I had a wonderful family at home. I had a nice job with the opportunity to go to college, and for my and I hate to say this, but it's the truth. This lending institution I was working for, they're still in existence today. Isn't that horrible? I mean, I could have really still been with them, you know. I mean, that still kills me when I say that. But alcohol took it. But the point is that they patted me down. They read me my rights. They put me in the back of their unmarked car. They took me to a place called the Wagner Building, which is a federal building, and I got booked for the first time. Sideway picture. I can do fingerprints pretty good. You know, I got that down. And my parents pretty much excommunicated me from the family. If you're a Catholic, you know what that means. That means just go, don't come back, ever. You know, there's like not even like a small window open. It's just like, goodbye. And trust me, that wasn't a lot of things that happened up to that point. A lot of, you know, with my alcohol, drinking and thinking and talking and acting all the way through high school, where this was just finally the tip of the iceberg. And they just, you know, I tried to call home. There was clicks. There was no, like, love there. It was like that tough love Al-Anon stuff. You know what I mean? And they just gave me, tough love. And it was great because it got me sober eventually. But so anyway, now I got sent away. A federal depository. You don't take money from a federal depository for any amount of time and then just get a slap on the wrist. They just can't do that. Yeah, I got sent away. I got sent away for a year to a penal institution. And I'm here to tell you that there were many sleepless nights. You know, it says in the big book, we share in a general way what it used to be like, so that's all you're getting. But the point is that it was horrible. It was horrific. Every minute of doing a year in this joint was absolutely. You know, I'm in there with kids that had been in reform schools. You know what I mean? I was in there with real tough guys that talked the talk, had the cigarette hanging out of their mouth, and the tattoos, and the, you know, in the drawers, and the muscle man t-shirts, and the shower shoes, playing spades. And I'm a Catholic kid that has a problem with drinking. You know, that's as far as I was concerned, you know what I mean? And then if I told them I robbed a bank, they wouldn't believe me, you know? So, I mean, it was a horrible year. It was absolutely, and it was the truth, but it was a horrible, horrible year. Many a night I did that practicing alcoholic prayer. Oh, dear Father, please, please get me out of this one. I'll never do it again. Ever. 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 Oh, I swear to you, please don't let Carlos see me tomorrow going to jail. You know, don't let Reggie, you know, look at me the way he's been looking at me and that crazy Italian. Don't, oh, come on, man. And I just hated life. It was horrible. It was horrible. I'm not going to kid you. And I got out, and the first night I drank, you see. And that's just, I'm an alcoholic. An alcoholic has, you know, no mental defense at certain times against the first drink. I didn't have no mental defense. I couldn't up here. You know, I can't act my, you know, I can't think my way into right acting. I hear that a lot from speakers, and it's so true. But I got to act my way into right thinking. Somehow, me coming up here tonight, driving a couple of miles, dedicating a little bit of my time to here, and then finally driving home and listening to some nice CDs, thank you, Mike, of AA, somehow, my day tomorrow is going to be awesome. If I had said no, when I got asked to do this on Friday afternoon. I bet you tonight or tomorrow I wouldn't have felt as good as I'm going to feel now, because I'm acting my way in the right thinking. Because my thinking was so off. Anyway, I started going in and out of jails. I started going in and out of rehabs. I started living on the streets. I started I used to take money from cars. All right. Then I started sleeping in the cars. Then I just started taking a whole darn car. You know what I mean? Like, this is the way my progression went. I started just doing things that were horrible. Start, you know, taking little things when the store was open, learning how to hide in the store. You know, I don't want to give you any good hints of things to do if you're going to go back out. But I'll tell you what, man, I used to rob stores, man, by just sleeping in them and then waking up and realizing, wow, where'd they all go? And I might as well take some things with me then, you know? And anyway, it was horrible. I got caught at everything I did. I didn't have to worry about when I got to AA if I got caught. I did all my time. I did it and did it whatever. Point is that my life was horrible. I missed my parents. I missed my little sister who was 4 years my junior. But guess what? Alcohol was too important. It says in the big book, it says, remember that I hear a lot of neat things in Alcoholics Anonymous. And a lot of them, I have to really break down and ask myself, why is the speaker or the person that's sharing saying this? One of the things I hear a lot from people with time is, you know, it's not about the drinking no more. Okay, it's about living and all this. And I know that all sounds good, but I know when there's a newcomer in the room, remember to how it works says remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, and powerful. And I got 20 years of sobriety, and for me it still is about the drinking. Now if I ever think it's not about the drinking, then I better I'm going to forget where I came from, because I'm going to go meet Reggie and Carlos and Vinny again. I will. I'm telling you, there's a cell in Graterford Penitentiary waiting for me. And I know that with all my heart and soul. I don't got this thing licked yet, and I hope I never do. My sponsor told me I'll be on good spiritual ground when I'm 6 feet under. You know, it takes all the fun out of that little part in the big book. But anyway, so that was my life. Got to get my little part to the basket. That was my life. Just one jail after another, one prison after another, living on the streets, gospel missions. I know what that's like. Salvation armies. I can sing some songs today because of Salvation Army. All right, I'll do whatever it takes to get a meal. All right. I was good at hiding booze, you know, bottles of booze. And I'm a kid, too. I'm 20 years old. I'm 21 years old. And I'm going to these places. I'm with 50 and 60 and 70-year-old men. I really am. Wayward women, whatever, fallen women, as Bill says, I love that. But and it's just a horrible way to live. But guess what? You couldn't tell me at the time that I wasn't having a great time. You see, that illusion that the big book talks about, that delusion that I lived in. You know, I just always thought that I was okay. You know, if I got, like some people, like when they, if somebody was like me and they got that year in a prison at 18 years old, they'd probably not drink anymore. But see, that would be a non-alcoholic as far as I'm concerned. You see, perhaps if some, like their girlfriend breaking up with them after 4 years, I guarantee a non-alcoholic would go to her and probably, or him, and say, I see where I've been wrong. I'm not going to drink this week. See, that never even came into my mind. All I thought about was, isn't this horrible? I'd never considered not drinking. I never considered stopping drinking. Does that make any sense here? I just didn't. That's why so many of us are so upset when we get here and we get told, just don't pick up the first drink. It's like, oh, come on. I know it's more than that. I mean, just don't drink. That's all. Well, there's a few more things, and we'll get with them as it goes on. But just for today, until tomorrow night, till the meeting tomorrow afternoon, in fact, I'll pick you up, don't drink until then. Like, all right. And that's all it is, man. You know, getting that stuff out of our system. You know, and then we got to start, obviously, putting some new stuff in. And that comes with time if we have good sponsors. But anyway, my last drunk. I'm in Exton, Pennsylvania. Okay, I'm at the Exton Square Mall. Okay, does anybody know where that is? In Exton, Pennsylvania. Well, it doesn't matter. I'm there, and there's a Hickory Farms, and I'm hungry. Okay, and of course, I only got money for booze. So I go in there, and I proceeded to put a thing of, you know, those round things of salami and cheese. I put them down my pants. I have an army coat on, so I got the... I've never been in the army because they wouldn't take me, but I got juicy juices in my pockets. And I'm getting ready to go out. And I'm alcoholic, but I'm sober at this moment. And the last thing I remember is like an 85-pound cute little blonde with blue eyes flying through the air, okay? And she tackled me. I swear she played football to this day, right? And then she held me down till the police got there. That was so humiliating. And I'll tell you what, I remember getting led through the mall, you know, as a drunk, you know, by these, you know, the mall police. You know what those guys look like? It's horrible, man. You talk about incomprehensible demoralization. It was horrible. On a Sunday, there's families there enjoying, and here I am going through the mall. These two cops are so excited; they got one, you know. And then the mall police, the real police from Exton came, and they locked me up. I'll have you know, this is wild. I got 1 to 2 years. It's actually called 11 and a half to 23 months in Chester County Farms Prison for stealing salami and cheese. Sounds like a lot of time. I wasn't too happy with that, you know. But the reality of it is, there's that, like, you can't barter. I'm a salesman. You can't barter with a judge. And I'm thinking, well, here's the problem. When I was out there drinking and I went to court, right, for something, if they, like, let me go and I had to pay, like, some court costs and I was lucky enough to have that or something, and they would give me a court date, yeah, I didn't have a day timer. You know what I mean? So I never showed up for court dates. I was just, like, so grateful that I wasn't going to jail that I'd say, okay, I'll see you next month, sir. Yeah, right. And then when I would get locked up for, like, the salami and cheese, all the other stuff that I had done that, you know, would catch up to me, and detainers, if anybody knows what that is, and all that, would just get lodged against me. You know, go to jail, don't pass go, do not collect $200, and we'll see you in a year and a half. Well, I was never going to do this year and a half. I did go to Chester County Farms Prison. I did get booked in. I did make it to population, and I did spend a little bit of time there, and then I did get in a fight. After getting in a fight in Chester County Farms Prison, I ended up on maximum security. You go to a hearing when you're inside a prison. If you get in any trouble, you get a hearing, administrative hearing, and then they put you away because you're like a problem. The last thing I need in a prison is problem people, and people are unhappy as it is. They want people like me away. And so they put me up on maximum security, gave me my own cell, brought my food to me. It was like being in a suite in a hotel. I thought, oh, this is better anyway, whatever. So they would bring me, I had my own yard with a little basketball court, I'll never forget it. I thought it was great. The problem at this point is, it says in the first step that we warped our minds into such a degree of destructive drinking, destructive drinking. My mind was warped at this point, okay? It was just warped. It was really warped. I'm 22 years old now. And again, from the time I was 17 when I got out of high school to 22, all I'm doing is drinking and getting in trouble. Drinking, getting in trouble. You know, institutionalized. All the medications they make, I've tried. I've tried every one of them, you know, because they gave them to me. I'll take them, sure. You know, I'll tell the prison counselor, I'm scared, I can't sleep at night, my neck hurts, whatever. Give me something to get me out of my head. So I know what all that stuff does to your head. It just gives you a buzz, like alcohol, as far as I was concerned. I was never really a drug addict, but I did anything I could to get that feeling. So anyway, I started singing in this prison. I like to sing between 1 and 6 in the morning, you know, at the top of my lungs. Now, prisoners are doing time. They want to just do their time peacefully and get out. You know what I mean? They don't need a jitterbug like me going crazy. So I didn't make friends at all. And then I couldn't really get them, they couldn't get to me because I was segregated in my own little cell. And so I would antagonize the correction officers. Yeah. And it was just a horrible, I was like, really horrible. Sometimes I wonder what was, but it was alcohol. It was just, you know, that, just what I did. I saturated myself with this poison, you know, that these spirits that they call it, for a long, long time. And it just took me to places that I just can't believe I've been, but I've been there. One day, Saturday afternoon, I hear all this pitter-patter coming up the tier. And I put my mirror, if anybody's ever been in jail, I put my mirror outside the thing, and I'm looking down, and what, God, is 4 or 5 guys, and they got the masks on and all that, and they're coming down, and they stopped right in front of my cell. And at that point, did you ever see Angels with Dirty Faces with Jimmy Cagney? Some of the older folks here, remember that, Angels with Dirty Faces? Well, Jimmy Cagney, in this movie, I'll bring you to it just for a second. Jimmy Cagney got sent to the gallows. He got sent to the electric chair, actually. Okay, and the priest came in, who he's known all his life, and he said, Jimmy, you've got to listen to me. all the boys, when you're going down to the gallows, they're going to be listening. And they're going to, and if you act like a tough guy, you're going to just kill them because they're going to want to be just like you. Jimmy, do me a favor. And please, Jimmy, just act like you're petrified. And he says, get out of here, Father. I don't want to hear your crap. Pretty much what he said. The next day came, the jailers came. It was, you know, dead man walking. He's going down. And all the guys, you see all the neighborhood kids. Go get him, Jimmy. You're a tough guy. Go get him. And then as the priest is listening, he's just down the trod, and he hears Jimmy say, don't do it. I can't go through with it. No. And he was screaming for his life. And he did that for the father, you see, to try to get those kids a decent life. He wasn't scared even one iota. Well, when these guards came to my cell, I screamed just like him, but I wasn't acting. I was just like that guy, and I was screaming for my life, and it was too late. It was over. These correctional officers beat me with an inch of my life, and it's a true story. Bill talks about, in the big book, he says that sometimes newcomers are shocked at our seeming worldliness and levity or our humor when they come in here. I know I was. When I went to my first convention, I was in some guy named Ernie the Attorney Sharon, and everybody's laughing. Ha, ha, ha. I'm sitting like this. You know, I can always tell a new person, by the way. I know when you share, I know the new people. I can just tell. Because you're just like sitting there like, everybody else is laughing. You're like, looking around, you know. But anyway, and it's all good. One day at a time, we'll get you. But the point is, Bill says, right, he says, but just underneath it is a deadly earnestness. Okay, and then he says, that's where faith has to live in and among us 24 hours a day. Well, here's how I'm going to get into the deadly earnestness. I woke up, I came to in the hole of Chester County Farms Prison, probably a little cell about this big, and in the floor was a hole, and that's it. And I was wrapped around it naked, okay, beaten and battered, I'm sure cracked ribs, I don't know, face all out, and naked. And the hole was there just to go to the bathroom. It seemed like an eternity, and finally the little thing opened up and a little light came through, and somebody yelled out, chow, and a tray of food came up there. I got the tray of food. I took the utensil, a plastic utensil, and I cut my arm up and down because I just couldn't go on any longer living like this. I was 22 years old, and I was, as far as I was concerned, I was ready to become a statistic. I hated myself. There was many times out there where I bounced back. I bounced back from Barb breaking up with me. I bounced back from getting some time. I bounced back from a fight. I bounced back from a horrible... I used to go to hospitals all the time, and they used to give me something to drink. If any nurses in here, I don't like you guys. They used to always give you something to drink to make you puke, you know, to get all that stuff out of my system. Oh, it was, if you know what that's like. And like, then after they get it all out, then they say, okay, you can go now. I had all those feelings. You see, but I always would bounce back from them because there'd always be a drink, there'd always be like something to retreat to somewhere at somehow. I was never at my full bottom. Well, I was finally in Chester County Farms Prison in the hole at my full bottom, and I tried to take myself out, and I tried to commit suicide as a 22-year-old kid. And for all intent purposes, my parents should have got a call, you know, that your son is no longer with us, that he took his own life. But for some reason, I woke up again. In the infirmary of this prison, and I had my arm wrapped in gauze, this whole left arm, in some thing. I remember having pictures taken of it, and then I remember going to a hearing inside this prison, and I got remanded to a place called Haverford State Hospital for my drinking. It wasn't for stealing salami and cheese, man. You know what I mean? It wasn't for robbing a bank. It wasn't... It's what we read and how it works. Remember that we deal with alcohol. Cunning, baffling, and powerful. It told me I didn't have a problem. It told me that I was okay. It told me I can do this time standing on my head. It told me I knew how to handle this rehab. It told me that this Kalamazoo gospel mission isn't that bad. It told me that, you know, whatever, Philadelphia Salvation Army is a good place to be. They got nice quarters or whatever. You see, it always lied to me. You know, because of that terrible obsession and compulsion. See, we deal with something very vital here, very scary, very horrific, and it's called alcoholism, you know. And When I went to Hereford State Hospital, I wasn't done. When I finally came to and got my wits about me like a real alcoholic, I was just belligerent. They put me on some medications to try to calm me down, and I got more belligerent. I got held down in those places in rubber rooms by attendants, orderlies, and had stuff shot in my rear end, you know, just to calm me down. I don't know what it's like just to lay there in a rubber room and have a door locked on me from drinking, all right? And that's why I'm here tonight. That's why I traveled up here tonight after I got done. I got done working at Exit 10 on the Garden State Parkway at 5 o'clock. And I made it here by 6:25 because it's like it says at the end of the first step. It says, you know, who cares to admit complete defeat? You know, who cares to sacrifice time and energy for the suffering alcoholic? You know, who cares for that prospect? No, not the average alcoholic. Self-centered in the extreme, they don't care for this prospect. But the one that does, for those of us that do, it's because our lives depend on it. That's me. My life depends on it. My life depends on being here right now and doing my little part tonight, carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, letting you guys know what it used to be like and what happened. And that's what it used to be like. And that's what happened. You know? Let me just finish up what happened. Eventually, I was living on the streets of Philadelphia. Two police officers came by, okay? They picked me up. I was a vagrant. I had no identification. I mean, I can show you my identification. I can show you my license. I got a college ID. How about that? I got pictures of my family on my coffee mug out there. I mean, I got a business card with all my numbers on. I'm very identifiable today, okay? Back then, alcohol had me identified, you see? That's it. That was the only thing. And you could just smell it if you were a police officer. And when a police officer would pick me up, they'd put me back in their blue paddy wagon. They'd take me to the district. They'd throw me away in some drunk tank. And you know what that's like? That's horrible. It's a horrible thing. Horrible. But it was okay. But it was normal for me. It was normalcy. It wasn't abnormal. It was normalcy. And then eventually I'll get arraigned. Judges used to give me time on the TV. And they didn't even give me the respect of going to court. You know what I mean? They should just go on the TV and say, okay, well, you got 60 days in the House of Correction. Great. You know? And before I could tell him something, he would just be gone. I'm like, jeez, you know? Or whatever. It was horrible. It was a horrible way to live. It was a horrible life. But I accepted it because I wanted to drink. And no one was telling me I couldn't. I'm drinking. I'm okay. You see? I'm okay. Don't worry about it. I didn't care what I was doing to my dad. I didn't care what I was doing to my mom. I didn't care what I was doing to my poor little sister. She had girlfriends that she went through high school with and never even knew she had a brother because she was too ashamed of me. You see, I didn't care. I just wanted to drink. Just me. This selfishness and self-centeredness to the maximum degree. And I didn't know it. I didn't know it. I didn't sit at a bar and say, I'm an alcoholic, give me another drink. I didn't know it. I didn't know it was doing it to me. And all those things I was going through, you'd think something would have woke me up. But I didn't know it. It's cunning, baffling, and powerful. And without help, it was too much for me. And I didn't get no help. I don't know why. Maybe I didn't want it. Maybe I didn't accept it. Maybe I didn't hear it. I don't know. But I just know I kept on going on and kept on going on and kept on going on. And these two cops picked me up that night in Philly. They took me to a 7-Eleven, let me out of the back of the blue paddy wagon. And this is where Footprints takes over, that wonderful poem. And they told me to open up my hands, and I did. I didn't do nothing. They woke me up out of a drunken slumber. They said, open up your hands, and I did. And they gave me a whole handful of change. And they said, go and talk to the guy inside. And I watched him pull away. And I walked inside, and I said to the guy, hi, how you doing? And there was only one guy in there with a pair of jeans and a T-shirt on. Very nondescript, nothing special about him. And he shook my hand, and he said, my name's George, and I'm an alcoholic. And I said, really? And he went on to tell me his story. And it was horrible. He told me a story of the abuse he had went through as a kid and how he abused his sister and his drinking story. And it was absolutely horrific. And I'm so sick, I couldn't understand why he was telling me this. I'm sitting there listening to this saying, why is this guy? I mean, I enjoyed the story, don't get me wrong. But, I mean, it was really wild. And I can't. That's the alcohol, folks. You know, it's just in front of me. You know what I mean? It's just like you can't get. Remember, Get Smart? All those things, the door, you had to get through all those to get through to me somehow. and kept on telling me all night, and slowly but surely, like it says in working with others, slowly but surely, you can win over the confidence of another alcoholic if you just tell them your story, not the principles right away, by golly. You don't have to work the 12 steps with them. You don't have to get the, like Bill used to give the religious deal right away, and you know, and Dr. Silkworth had to say, no, you're missing it, Bill. Just tell them what you've been doing for these first 6 months and maybe it'll work. Well, that's what this dude did to me. He just carried the message and said he wasn't drinking. And in order for him not to drink for another day or two, he told the cops to bring him somebody like me. You know, a fellow that might be worth saving, that reeked of booze. You know what I mean? And he did, and they did that, and he helped me, and he took me home with him, and he got me to AA. And I stayed sober for 5 months, went to meetings. This is in May of 83. And then one day I made that decision to rob somebody. I didn't even drink. I just robbed somebody. Okay? He's like the guy who puts the shot of whiskey in his milk in the big book. Well, I just robbed somebody. And it was a guy that was an AA guy that was setting me up with pretzels on the streets. And I took all his pretzels and made $500 and got drunk. And I ended up in Kalamazoo, Michigan, drunk. I don't even know where Kalamazoo, Michigan is. Okay? And to boot, some guy was standing over me. I woke up in this hotel called the Crosstowns Motel, and this guy was standing over me saying, "You're fired." And I said, "Okay, what was I doing?" You know what I mean? Like, I didn't know. I was selling magazines door to door and state to state. Some of it's come to me since that time. But then he gave me $100 to get back home. I said, "Thank you very much, sir." And I ended up proceeding to spend that whole $100 on booze. I met a wonderful girl named Tracy. She was a prostitute. And we ended up getting together and hanging out. I just thought she was great. I loved her, whatever. But now, the point of all of it is, and the finality of all this is I finally hit my bottom in Kalamazoo, Michigan. You see, and it wasn't a jail, it wasn't a prison, it wasn't a drink, it wasn't nothing. It was when I laid down in a field and I looked up in the heavens and I said, "Please help me, Father. I can't do this anymore. I can't do it no more." The wonderful alcoholic prayer. I can't, help me, please help me. And I hope if you're a newcomer, especially, that you at some point, if you haven't done it already, ask for help. And that's all I had to do. And something came over me. I can't explain it. It was like the third step right away. I turned my will and my life over to the care of God's understanding. Right away, something came over me. And I ended up in the middle of Kalamazoo, Michigan. And I asked somebody where Alcoholics Anonymous was. And they told me there was a big building right across the street. It was called the Alano Club, short for Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went in there on October 31st of 1983, drunk. And all night, two people sat with me all night, good alcoholics. They didn't judge me because I smelled of booze or that I might have had some gospel mission clothes on or that I was staying with a prostitute. All they said was, "Welcome. Welcome. Would you like a cup of coffee? Would you like a burger or a couple eggs or something?" And they told me to come back the next day. And the next day I came back, and that was November 1st, 1983. And I walked through the doors on November 1st of 83 as a sober man, and I haven't looked back since. I haven't had a drink, a drug, a mind or mood altering substance. Nothing. Nothing. Never. Ever. I don't have to. You know, because I finally found out what this deal was about. Now, what it's like today. What happened? What it's like today. I was out there in Kalamazoo, Michigan. 3 months, I was doing great. I wasn't drinking. I was going to meetings. I was, you know, halt, don't get too hungry, angry, lonely, tired. How? Honesty, open-mindedness, willingness. By golly, I'm getting it, man. There, but for the grace of God, go, I mean, I'm getting it. Think. You know, I'm really just getting it. I'm feeling it. I'm getting with the lingo. You know, I'm not, you know, screw you, you know, you butthead. And I'm getting that stuff out of my system. Okay? And I'm getting like, oh, man, it's first things first, man. Oh, easy does it, Marilyn, you know. Keep coming back, Joey, and all this crap, you know, because that's what you guys are doing. So that's what I'm doing, right? And then, but apparently I wasn't doing it that good, because one day, 3 months sober, I showed up at the club, and they five guys told me that I was a topic at a business meeting the night before, and I was no longer allowed on their premises. So, yeah, I was pretty bad. I had ACDC. Cut off t-shirts, and I guess I didn't talk the lingo properly. So I didn't have time to think. I didn't have time to drink. I didn't have time to think, do nothing. I went out on the sidewalk, and I sat on the sidewalk. And before I had time to ponder my choices, I didn't know what I was going to do. A pig farmer come up and out of the, he's an alcoholic named Don C. And he said, "Come on, man." and I hopped in his truck, and he had one of those blades from one of those chainsaws. You know, he had that blade around his rearview mirror. I mean, I didn't know what I was getting into, but it had to be better than what I was doing, right? So I got in his truck, and he took me out in the woods. I'm picturing all kind of crazy stuff's getting ready to happen to me, man. And he showed up at this wonderful home, and he had AA things all over the house. His wife, who was a nurse, came home. Her name was Rhonda. She welcomed me to the house. His two little boys named Brian and Dallas were 3 and 7, and they welcomed me into the home like I was a big brother. For the next 9 months, they nursed me back to sobriety. And he took me to meetings that would put up with my nonsense, as Bill Wilson says. And I got sober. A year. He got me on welfare. You know, I'd never been on welfare. I always worked. I was able-bodied. But he got me on welfare because he told me I had a disability, and that's called alcoholism. And he got me to meetings, and I was on welfare, and everything was going good for about 3 months. And then all of a sudden, I got a letter in the mail. He did. Don did. Don C. from Kalamazoo, Michigan. And it said, it was to my attention. And it said that we're grateful you're taking advantage of the Michigan Department of Welfare. And if you'd like to continue to get it, we're going to give you a job. And so I talked to Don, and he said, oh, yeah, sure, do it. You'll be fine. You can still go to meetings. The job was, it was really wild. It was from 4 a.m. to 8 a.m. in the morning. Isn't that neat? At a dairy farm right up the road, right? It said, show up the following day and ask for Claire. So I'm thinking, you know? So I got a nice pair of jeans on, my tightest jeans. You know what I mean? I'm going to the farm. I'm going to meet Claire, you know? And I'm sick. I'm only 6 months sober. And so I show up, and here's this dude with red hair with about 3 teeth with big suspenders on. Says, hey, I'm Claire. You the new guy? Right? And I'm like, oh, my God. You know? All I could picture at that moment was like that movie Deliverance with Burt Reynolds. Did you ever see it? I, you know, it never happened in jail, but I'm thinking, oh, it's happening in this barn. You know what I mean? I'm getting really concerned. And forgive me, but it's the truth. And so I go in the barn. Now, it's 1984. I'm 6 months sober. So I'm figuring it's going to be machines. Wouldn't you surmise that? It's 1984. I go in, all I see is cows, and it stinks, you know? And so this dude sits down. I'm 6 months sober. This dude sits down and starts milking a cow. He's got a pail, all right, and a stool. And so I'm thinking, maybe I'll be an apprentice, you know? Maybe I'll just watch him for a while. Wouldn't that make sense, right? Because I can't milk cows, right? I'm sober. And maybe if I was drunk, I'd take a shot at it. But and so this guy's milking cows, and then he says, okay. I'm like, what do you mean? He says, okay. And I had to sit there, and it's so humiliating, folks. I'm from the city, and I like milk. I never wanted to get disinvolved. I'm milking the cow. And I mean, I'm a guy. It just didn't feel right. I'm going like this. You know what I mean? I'm sorry. And I'm milking this cow. It's 6 months sober. There's hornets going around. Now, I got to share something with you. We had dogs growing up in Philadelphia, all right? And we would let them out to go to the bathroom. You with me? So I would figure, wouldn't it make sense? There's big pastures there. It would make sense to me that somehow they train these cows to go out to the pastures to go to the bathroom. I'm sitting there milking a cow with 6 months sober, and here it comes. Like I swear to God, I'm not saying this for fun, to be funny. Here comes number one, number two, all at once. There's steam coming up. It's 4:30 in the morning. It's freezing. I'm sitting there with some farmer I don't know, and all I can hear is some old guy Jake from the meeting the night before saying, things beyond your wildest dreams are going to happen. Oh, God. Is that horrible? But I left that farm at 8 in the morning. I'll have you know, I only worked on a dairy farm for one day. Okay? I went to McDonald's the next day, and I got a job. And I've been a member of the workforce ever since. I finally came home to Philadelphia. I went a year of sobriety, and I turned myself in the authorities for something that I had neglected to do before I got sober. And I did another full year, 6 months in a place called House of Correction, and 6 months in a halfway house called Genesis 2 in North Philadelphia. And then I finally got paroled with 2 years sober to Wildwood, New Jersey. And I started getting active in AA. I mean, I was about AA, every fiber in my body. I mean, I just was. You know, I had to learn how to date again. I had a sponsor, and, you know, I'm going to go out with this girl. What do I do? You know, get her some chocolate strawberries, take her to a movie. Okay, I'll do that. And I had to call my baby. Hey, I kissed her, dude. You know, oh, good. Make a meeting tomorrow morning. Talk about it, whatever. You know, and whatever. And I had to relearn how to do stuff as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know what I mean? I wasn't drinking. I missed all this stuff. Never had a license. Some guy in the program, his father took me and help me get my driver's license. You see, I never did that. I was too involved in booze, man. And one thing led to another, and at 6 years sober, guess what happened? I called home in 1989, on December 20th to be exact, and I asked my mom if she would mind if I came home for the holidays. It took me 6 years. There was a lot of alcathons in the middle of there. There was a lot of, you know, being a secretary and chairman to the group and a grapevine representative. And I did it. You know what I mean? I did everything that was asked. You know, I set up the cookies. Whatever I had to do, I kept on staying sober no matter what. And December 25th of 1989, I showed up in front of my house in Northeast Philadelphia with me, a little Volkswagen Beetle, and this program they call Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was a little bit humiliating because my sister was there who hadn't seen since she had to been 12 last time I'd seen her. And now she is a college student, and she was married to a ball player, actually, who was there. Her new husband was there. So it was kind of humiliating, and I AA gave me the courage to do it. And there was a lot of crying and hugging, and they welcomed me home. My dad went upstairs. Okay, I was 6 years sober and came down. I grew up as a Philadelphia Eagles fan, and he and I both did. And he came down with a whole bag of gifts for me. And there was like Eagles sweatshirts and Eagles hats and a football and all that. And my dad knelt in front of me so no one else could hear it. And he said, "Welcome home, son. So proud to have you home. We've been waiting for you." Like, that's like stuff out of the Bible. And like, that ain't supposed to happen to me. I'm supposed to die. I'm supposed to be dead. I'm supposed to be statistic. You know, I'm supposed to be out there, you know, just rotting away. And yet, Alcoholics Anonymous brought me to this point. 2 years later, I get a call. I'm 8 years sober now, and I get a call, and it's my little sister. And she was crying. And she asked me to come up to her suburb home up in upstate Pennsylvania. And I went up there. Took my car, 8 years sober. I, at that time, I was a manager of a fast food restaurant. I went up there, and her husband was running around on her, and this ball player, and they were going through a divorce, and she couldn't tell my parents. And guess who she told? Me. And I remember, I'll still never forget the first night, and like, this is how rewards happen. You don't know when they're going to happen. If you're a new guy, don't, you know, girl, don't stop. You don't know. Remember, we were laying on her big couch, this big old room with a fireplace on, and watching Johnny Carson or something. And she was at one end and I was at the other end with the blankets, like we used to do as kids in my house. And she was just so proud to have her brother back. And she was going through a horrible time. But she asked me to come help her and to listen to her. You don't get any better rewards than that as far as I'm concerned. It wasn't monetary or none of that. It was just being a brother again. Being a son, you know. And 10 years sober, I was at a wedding. My buddy was getting married. He's in AA to a girl I knew in AA, and I'm there, and I'm with a girl in AA, you know. And here's this cute little girl, young lady, 19 years old, and we did electric slide. It was the guy that was getting married. My buddy's little cousin. He would never introduce me to her, but somehow I gave her my number, and she's my wife today. She liked me. She liked me. 10 years sober, and she's not one of us. She's normal. She's like, you know, she's non-alcoholic. Forgive me, we're all normal. She's a non-alcoholic, and we started dating. And she just anything I was doing, I was a DCM at the time in service, and she would go out to my workshops and go out to my district meetings. You know, I ended up running for alternate delegate of the area. She came out to the elections and was up in the front row cheering. You know, they picked my name out of the hat to be the delegate of Southern New Jersey, and she was out there giving me the thumbs up. You know, and she'd become my soulmate, and these are the kind of things that happen. Now I'm 14 years sober, 15 years sober, and I'm getting ready to go out to a Northeast Regional Delegates meeting in Schenectady, New York. We've got this big agenda. We're going to deal with all this stuff, new pamphlets to the Black African-American Alcoholic. Is A&E going to do a documentary on Bill Wilson and all this stuff? We got to deal with all this stuff, and I'm getting ready to go, and I got my stuff, and I got my suits all, and it's a Friday morning, and I'm ready to go out the door, and she says, "Sit down." You know, and I can follow directions, I told you. So I sat down. And she says, "I got something to show you." And I thought, oh my God, what did I do? You know, I wasn't sure. I couldn't think of nothing off the top of my head. And she come in, and she on a platter, she had a little rattle, and she had one of those little strips that had a plus sign in the middle of it. And she told me I was going to be a father. With 14, 15 years of sobriety, You see? These are things at 37 years old. These are things that aren't supposed to happen to me. These aren't things that I'm supposed to die. I'm supposed to be in a prison. I'm supposed to be in a mental hospital somewhere. I'm supposed to be in a penitentiary somewhere. You see? But no. Through the grace of God, unmerited gift, I got rewarded with this wonderful program. You see? 2 years ago, I was asked to come to Albuquerque, New Mexico, to carry the message to young people at an international convention. And I was excited. My wife was excited. And whenever you're asked to be a speaker at a big convention, they pay for you and the wife. And it's just a neat deal. And, oh, it's just so cool. And we're all excited about it. And all of a sudden, phone rings, and my wife said, "It's your mom." It's about a week before we're going out, maybe a week and a half. And I get on, and my mom says, "Can you please come over, son? Something's wrong with Daddy." I run. I get over there. I drive over there, and my father's stomach had blown up. And he was very healthy, 72 years old, as healthy, skinny, athletic, went to the Eagles games with him all. I mean, he's just, you know, a real charged-up guy, and he was just horrible. It was just, I could tell something was wrong, and we got him to the hospital, and again, they had to fix his plumbing right away, so to speak, and the doctor told me, you know, it was bad. After they, you know, did the test and they saw the masses in there and all, and my mom was staying with us, and it was just a sullen time. It was horrible. We were going there every day. I didn't go to work, and it was just watching them. Now, I sponsor a cardiologist from my home group named Dr. Mike. Dr. Mike, through the grace of God, works at this hospital, and Dr. Mike was watching over my pop. And he would give me daily reports and let me know what was going on. And I remember I was there the Wednesday before I'm supposed to go to Albuquerque with my wife. Now, by this point, Dad's on that defibrillator or whatever it's called, ventilator. And he's getting oxygen and all. And I remember telling my wife was there, my mom was there, and Dr. Mike was there, and my pop was there, just in some type of coma state. And I said, "You know, guys, Carol and I aren't going away this weekend. It's my wife's name. We're just going to stay home, and I want to be here for Dad. I know he'd want me here." And Dr. Mike looked at me and looked at everybody and said, "Could you excuse me and Rob for a second?" And my wife and mom left the room, and they had already known what was getting ready to happen. And he proceeded to tell me that when my father came into the hospital, he was very cognizant, and that Dr. Mike had a few, he told me I had a quite a few sessions with him, and I got to talk to him and all that, and he told me that you were getting ready to go to Albuquerque, New Mexico to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous out to a bunch of young people that were once just like you, and how important it was to you, and how important it was to him, and how proud he was of you to be doing something like that. And Rob, he said, he talked about you all the time and what you were doing. My sister's a successful lawyer in New York, da 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 now, and she's married to a CBS cameraman and all that. And he said, he might have said one or two things about her, but he talked about you incessantly, about you guys going to the Eagles games and your breakfasts and all that. And he says, "Go to the conference. Carry the message of AA, and I'll keep Dad alive." I went to the conference. It was a great conference. I didn't talk about my father. I came home, and that Monday, I was holding my pop's one hand, and my mom was holding his other hand, and we let him go peacefully. You see, they kept my father alive because they knew how important all of them made that decision. Without me there, I think I went out to get coffees for everybody, and they made a decision to keep my father alive, you know, for me to go out to the conference. That's how important they knew Alcoholics Anonymous was. So that's what happens, you know, to a kid like me that gets sober in this wonderful fellowship, you know. I'll end with this little story, and we'll wrap this thing up just about my hour. There's a story of a football player that my sponsor told one time that I just love. I think it talks all about our program. This football player was a wonderful, wonderful running back for this NFL team. And his father, of course, he made pretty good portion of money. His father always had headphones on in his stands, you know, because his father was blind. He couldn't see him play. But he would always hear, you know, the radio, and there goes Walker, 10, 5, and another touchdown. And as he would score the touchdown, he'd spike the ball, he'd look up in the stands, and his father would be going like this in the air. And it was just wonderful, right? End of the season comes, and now they're in the championship game. They win that. His father's up in the stands, great deal. And now it's the Super Bowl. And isn't it wonderful? And everything's gone great. And you know, his father's listening to him do the interviews on TV and just so proud of him. And all of a sudden, of course, he got his dad a great seat down low. And all of a sudden, they're in the locker room, and the coach is giving the rah-rah. and the call comes into the locker room, and it was the fact that Walker's father had passed away on the way to the stadium, a major heart attack. The dilemma for the coaches, what were they going to do? What could they do? What could they do at that point? I mean, if we tell Walker, by golly, we'd have got no shot to win this game, you know? So they're running out in the field, and the head coach pulled Walker aside and said, kid, I got to tell you something. It pains me to tell you this, but we just got word that your father passed away on the way to the game. He had a major heart attack. He's gone. He's at blank, blank hospital. You're welcome to leave. We would all understand 100%. And Walker went out with the rest of the team, and they're on the sidelines, and the coin toss went off, the kickoff and receiving team went off, and all of a sudden it's time for the offense to go out. Walker put his helmet on and ran out in the field, much to the amazement to his coach and team. And he had one of the best games of his career. Touchdown to touchdown to touchdown, and of course his team won the Super Bowl. And as everybody at the end of the game, and they got their sons on their shoulders, and the adulation, and where are you going? I'm going to Disneyland, and everything's going on. Just like in The Longest Yard with Burt Reynolds, Walker was walking off into one of the tunnels all by himself, his head down. The coach ran up to him, caught him, put his arm around him, looked him in the eye, and said, Walker, I'm so proud of you. How did you do that? And as Walker looked up to him with his eyes filled with tears, he said, Coach, don't you get it? My dad finally got to see me play. You see? And for the new guys and the new girls, that's the kind of faith we got to have in Alcoholics Anonymous. I know you can't see it. I know you can't see yourself being a successful person someday. I know you can't see yourself being a good person. I know you can't see yourself being full of self-esteem right now. I know you can't see yourself facing all those things you might have to face and getting sober. But see, we can. And you got to have that faith. You got to look at us, those that have done it before you, and realize you're no worse than us, man. You're no worse than us. In fact, you're just like us. And so I say to you, as I impart upon you, one last thing. It's the same thing my father said to me, you know, back in 1989, those two words when he kneeled in front of me, you know, especially if you're a new person, welcome home. Thank you.